You know, if we make it as far into quantum communications as our guest David Cerita says we can, then everybody will know what you're thinking. It'll be amazing to measure your output, both your mental and your physical output, if you will, as you will change the physical space around you with the power of your mind. If you can unlock it from the constraints which David Cerita says other people have imposed upon us, even though they know we are capable of so much more. Research has been done at university-level research facilities for years, and they have come up with results which scare the government, David Cerita says, and that's why you're not allowed to know what he's about to tell you about quantum communications next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So David Cerita, who not only does research on his own as a scientist, but also as a filmmaker, puts it into a very entertaining form. Quantum Communications is his latest DVD, and it's part one and part two on the same DVD. I think it's intriguing and it's star-studded, filled with many well-known scientists and the work that they've been doing along the lines of the power of our minds, what it is that we are capable of doing. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Ian. It's good to hear your voice. It's been a while.
Yes, and I really loved how you put this together. So let's start for people who are familiar with the word quantum and also communications but don't often hear them used together in the same term. What do you mean by that?
Well, quantum physics was, founded by Max Planck, the Nobel Prize winner in physics, this is really quite amazing. The word quantum just comes from the root word quanta, or amount. And quantum mechanics, studies the nature of reality at the size of the atom or the scale of the atom and smaller, going into all the subatomic particles. In fact, the name Planck length is the smallest distance ever measured and is usually referred to in the study of quantum mechanics. And the idea that there is a dialogue going on and communication between all subatomic systems has been known for a long time. In fact, it has been known even by the father of quantum mechanics himself, Max Planck, that consciousness is a force. He actually says, there is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force, which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force is the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter. And then Max Planck says he regards consciousness as fundamental and matter as a derivative from consciousness. So this is where we start. This is the man who founds quantum physics and the study of quantum mechanics. And Einstein has not yet been born. Einstein actually didn't do well in college, was a lowly patent clerk. And there he is writing these theories and studying patents, and he wants somebody to hear him. And if it wasn't for Max Planck, the godfather of quantum physics, Einstein wouldn't be Einstein. The fact that Planck was open to somebody who was not even a PhD, not even a traditional scientist, is remarkable. And later, Einstein says anyone who becomes seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that there is a spirit manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man. So what's amazing to me and what kind of, drove me to make this, new DVD is that consciousness has not been accepted among the forces, and yet it should be. In fact,
And we'll get to all of this. You're kind of rushing ahead a little bit because I think all of this has to kind of be unpacked as we go along.
Yeah.
And I really like that's part of why the argument for quantum communications is still so strong. But I go back to the question. When you say quantum and communications, you're really talking about interpersonal communication and then also sort of internal communication being done at a much higher level than we've ever thought possible before.
Yeah, I think that's a good explanation. Absolutely.
But I think that's important to establish here that what we're talking about is not just sort of highbrow physics, which is always interesting and, you know, always something which pushes us into new directions, but that also we're talking about our own personal, the person who's listening to us right now, their own personal capability. And we go back to people like Max Planck and other people, and we say, how long have they known what we were capable of doing, but were either they said it and it just never got traction at the time, or they were talking about it and they were doing research about it, which was suppressed. So let's talk about some of the earliest research in this concept of our ability to communicate at what we would describe as like a quantum level. How far back does that go?
Well, as far as I know, it goes back to 1927, to the Fifth Solvay Conference on Quantum Mechanics in Brussels, Belgium, when Niels Bohr and Heisenberg come to Einstein and say, look, it looks like the minds of the researchers are affecting the results at the quantum level, and that we need to, you know, we need to investigate this. And this is pre-atomic bomb, pre-World War I and World War II. So, in fact, it's very close to the beginning of World War II. And this stuff, this mind stuff, like when scientists say mind, they don't mean the brain, the human brain.
Right.
They mean a force of consciousness and intelligence in the universe that is that the brain can actually index. It can actually bridge that gap through a coupling link. What modern physicists like William Tiller or scientists like Tiller believe, there is a coupling link between the brain and mind. And so that's where it all starts in 1927. This is how long they've known it. And Claude Swanson, a modern MIT PhD physicist, says that, in fact, they've known this for so long, they actually remove any brains or lab assistants or anybody, and they remove them from the location of the experiment so they don't affect it.
Well, and I think this is an interesting point to make because watching your DVD, Quantum Communications, and anybody listening can link up to it through coasttocoastam.com, you kind of make two different arguments. And so I let's get into this right away. The idea of consciousness on the part of the scientist affecting the study of physics. And then also you talk a lot about the actual radio frequency output that each of us, whether we're aware of it or not, the sort of the electrical field that we create around us. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the idea of the electrical force field, if you will, that we're putting around us. It's generated by the electricity of our heart, correct?
Yeah, well, it's our heart and our nervous system. We run positive and negative ions, which are like, you know, bigger than atoms. Their ions are bigger than atoms, but they're very similar. And they run through our nervous system like wires are running through a radio set. Now, when wires run through a radio set, they go through a miniature coil, and most radios today are cell phones, and they produce radio waves, which travel at the speed of light and carry the human voice, like we're talking right now, all over the world. Our body works the same way. Our body has an electrical system that produces frequencies. German physicist Fritz Albert Popp actually proves and discovers that all bodies, including plants and even animals and mammals, humans, all of us are emitting light waves. And then Fritz Albert Popp, the discoverer of biophotons, discovers that these light emissions are in the invisible infrared, the full color spectrum from red to violet, and then into the ultraviolet near and far. That's as far as they've measured that all bodies are emitting light waves. And then, you know, Alain Aspect, a French physicist, discovers in the 1990s that the emissions of these light waves are very similar to radio stations on bioorganisms in that the atoms of which we are made of, these little atoms, every time they change wavelengths, when they go to a high-frequency spin state, the electron spins around the atoms inside of us. The atom emits a light wave carrying intelligent information, which is what a radio broadcast is or a TV broadcast.
Well, at our best, anyway. So yeah. But what's different about that, say, in the study of auras?
Well, nothing. The study of auras have proven the same thing, but it was considered fringe science. you know, like a lot of great things start out as fringe science and they eventually win Nobel Prizes. But, you know, when the human aura was discovered, that the body was emitting light, I mean, this goes back to this discovery of Curlian photography. And in fact, there's an incredible scientist from UCLA, full professor there, Dr. Valerie Hunt, whom in the 1970s and 80s was getting real-time photography of the human aura, the most stunning photography I've ever seen. And I can't even believe what's happened to it. I know she's appeared on Coast to Coast AM. She's retired now, and I'm just utterly, you know, awestruck at what she discovered. Not only the different colors that are emitted off of the human aura, but the effects of different amounts or amplitudes of those colors coming off of different human beings, and then being able to take the information band out of each color and analyze the information band and study, you know, why a person has a disease, why another person is healthy, and that the color, she found that, for example, people who have nervous system disorders, the color yellow helps heal the nervous system, and the blue-violet spectrum actually reduces pain. I mean, all kinds of amazing studies have been done on the aura, yet mainstream medical, even though she was a UCLA professor and a full MD, they don't accept it.
Right, right. All right, so then we have that branch of the science here of quantum communications. And we should probably say that anybody can do this. You have video in your DVD about just, you know, grabbing two ends of just a voltage output meter. Is that what the right?
Yeah.
And that the average person listening right now puts out somewhere between 30 and 100 millivolts of electricity at any given time. Is that the rough estimate?
Yeah, I mean, William Tiller did studies at Stanford. He found 50 to 100 millivolts. I personally tested between my wife and I about 600 to 700 people, you know, from attending different trade shows and lectures. And we found, you know, when you say the average person, now that may not be a healthy range. It's just what people are measuring out there. Between 30 and 100 millivolts. So children tend to be around 200, 250 that are healthy. The odd person is 300. And then, of course, William Tiller discovers that people with psychic abilities, Qigong masters, will have these sudden outbursts, very short bursts of, you know, 25,000 millivolts and higher.
Well, that comes down to like 3 volts, right? I mean, it's that you actually cross over from the millivolt category into the volt category.
Well, when you get to 3,000 millivolts, you're at 3 volts. So you think, but that's surface electrical tension. Now, that's measuring on the fingertips, or you can measure along the spine with any, you know, a homemade. You just buy these things at Radio Shack and put it in the 200M setting, get rid of the decimal point, and you have millivolts. So. But what's amazing is that at the HeartMath Institute, now what they discovered that the heart produces electromagnetism. So the heart is electromagnet, just like a radio is. It's actually producing 50 to 60 times more energy than the human brain. So this is the real core of our broadcasting center, where we broadcast all of our ideas, all of our thoughts and feelings, you know, how they go out into the universe, and how the law of attraction applies is actually much more. What we know about that now in quantum communication is much deeper than what was ever known before.
And that would make it like the brain is the radio studio, but the heart is the transmitter that sends the signal out.
Exactly. But part of the problem, and we'll see, I mean, the heart, where this goes is so magnificent because it starts in the body. It becomes the core of how we attract our soulmates, how we find love, how we find our future business partners. What we end up finding is that if our intention is pure and we're really coming from our heart on anything we want to manifest in our lives, and it's sincere and it's long-lasting, like whenever you really want something and it's a great passion, it becomes very long-lasting. I'll give you an amazing example, something that probably hardly anybody's ever thought of. When Einstein was, finishing his general theory of relativity, he needed photography of a solar eclipse to prove it. He needed to demonstrate that when the moon eclipses the sun, that the stars surrounding of the sun would go into an incorrect position only by a micro amount in photography because of the gravitational lensing effect of the sun's mass sitting in the fabric of space. It bends the light of the stars around the sun just a little bit. Now, he needed that to prove it. And this is really an amazing case of mind over matter, because what happens is August 21st, 1914, which is my birthday in the southern Russian, near Ukraine, like in the southern, which is actually where my Sarita comes from. But anyway, they needed a photography session of the eclipse to verify his theory. Otherwise, it didn't stand as a contender for the Nobel Prize. And what happens is they first get rejected for funding. They struggle for months and months and months to prepare for this. And finally, they get there with their cameras, the photographers, and it's cloudy, and nothing happens. And so the next three attempts in history for Einstein to get his conviction, it's cloudy every single time, but something happens. At the last second, the clouds clear, and they get the picture. And it's the third time they get the picture. All three times it was cloudy and the sun clears in the last minute. They get the proof that, yes, space is curved and his theory is correct. It's curved to the exact amount that his theory predicted. Mm. And because of that evidence, he wins the Nobel Prize. But the point is, the level of passion was so steady and so succinct and so consistent over time that this miracle happens, the clouds clear, and it actually has to do with this symbiotic relationship between the human heart and the sun itself, which is remarkable.
Okay, we'll get into more of that, because that is interesting. But I want to then go back to, again, we're sort of, from the very beginning, we're breaking these two thoughts out, mm-hmm. that the body has an electrical field which can, at its optimum, in the case of Qigong masters, healers can get up to 3 volts, like actually emit 3 volts momentarily out of the fingertips. And then also going back to the physicist's earliest observation that even their presence is enough to interrupt some of the outcomes from the research they're doing in wave technology. And that while they're investigating the physics of waves, they realize that even their presence is enough to affect the outcome. So when you said before that it was a matter of consciousness, that it was almost like the consciousness of the person was interfering with the results of the physics, why wouldn't we just say, well, that's the result of the radio frequency that the body is giving off, that is just the physical nature of giving off, you know, 200 millivolts, that was enough to throw off the physical research. Where are you with that?
Well, that's the ultimate question. In fact, I asked Claude Swanson that question, and, you know, and it's a brilliant question that you've come up with, because hardly anybody has ever thought of that, and I have thought of it. And what you come up with is when Heisenberg and Bohr came to Einstein, the problem was every different set of researchers would produce a different effect. And that would mean that if it's just the presence, or for example, if you use an infrared movie camera, you can see, you know, the human body is very bright. And if you use night vision goggles and you look at your buddy in the middle of the night, it'll almost blind you when you point it at the heart.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, but again, this is just part of the investigation into quantum communications. David Sarita has a new DVD out. You can link up to that through coasttocoastam.com. And so let's pick up that thought right there, just on how strong the consciousness really is. I think I have a metaphor for it. We'll see whether or not it flies with David Sarita. And then we'll talk about how we can change that. What is it that we're capable of doing, and why was it so scary to the government funders of these investigations that the information had to be suppressed? Hey, you know, you paid for this with your tax dollars, or at least your ancestors did, so we might as well get our money's worth, find out how it can change our lives coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM, it's my turn on a Sunday, and I'll be talking with an investigator with whom we visited early in the spring. He has a new book out that fast, however, and it follows up on his previous research about these ancient rune stones found in pre-Columbus America, and that these rune stones had gone misinterpreted literally for hundreds of years. But now they can be fully understood. Rune stones found from thousands of miles away, all connected by sacred geometry, which the author argues is proof that the Holy Grail made it here to America. We'll talk about who brought the Holy Grail here, what the Holy Grail was for them, and just how he was able to tie together all these rune stones from thousands of miles away into one map. And it's an amazing, if it's not true, it's an amazing geometric coincidence. We'll get to that coming up tomorrow night. The Hooked X, the story of the Hooked X, coming up tomorrow night, Sunday night, on Coast to Coast. Back with David Sirita and the further investigation into quantum communication. Just what is it that you're capable of doing? If you knew that you could start tomorrow next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Researcher and documentarian David Sirita. The new work is called Quantum Communications. So here's where we left it, that we, as human beings, we put out an electrical field around us that is small but can be increased if we make a practiced attempt at doing that. And we also have a level of consciousness which seems to have an impact above and beyond the words we say or the gestures that we use to communicate those thoughts, that just merely our presence and the consciousness that we're experiencing is enough to tie us into the consciousness that floats around us. How's that?
That's great. That's a good synopsis. But there, you know, even though the heart is transmitting, you know, most of the electromagnetism in the body, it is the core, and we look at, you know, heart disease being the number one killer, 7 million people per year. And even countries like India are going to be 60% of the totality of that 7 million per year is coming from India because of stress. In fact, you know, I interviewed a doctor, you know, head, you know, oncologist,
right,
in Los Angeles, Dr. Michael Chaikin, and this is not traditional. Most heart specialists do not believe in the mind-body connection. They tell you it's, you know, hereditary, it's your diet, that's what causes the heart
right.
disease. But he's saying there's definitely a mind-body connection. So if we are not honoring our number, our core power center in our body, firstly, we have a very weak transmitter just on that basis alone. But second, if we're not in love with what it is we want to manifest through our core reactor, if we're not passionate about it, the signal is going to be very, 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 very weak. And, you know, this is, you know, kind of my argument to The Secret, for example. Like if you, and William Tiller found this, this is kind of the secret to the law of attraction.
And this is William Tiller, a physicist, well-known researcher in this field.
Yes, it's, you know, spent 30 years at Stanford University. And what he does is he traps a perfect human intention in an bioelectrical device called an IIED, and he traps it there. It's really the most amazing thing, just to get a human emotion and thought combined, trapped in an electrochemical device. And the intention that's imprinted on this IIED is to tell water at a distance to raise its pH value or lower it. Now, here's the greatest secret that I learned from Tiller, is that it took 30 days with a perfect intention, regardless of distance, even 6 or 7, almost 7,000 miles away, the pH of the water went up a full pH unit every time. And when a scientist like Dr. Tiller does this, he doesn't just do it once. He doesn't just do it 10 times.
Right.
He does this for years and years and years and years and years until he publishes his data. That's how conservative he is. But what this experiment tells us is that this goes back to your question about, you know, did the minds of the researchers affect the results in the quantum experiment because of their bioemissions in close proximity?
Right.
The answer is it wasn't just their bioemissions. It's actually the consciousness, because consciousness not only has to travel through mountain ranges, through solid rock, through walls, through all these distances, which, and this was a study done by MIT physicist Claude Swanson in his work, he documents that no matter what the barrier is for consciousness, whether it's rock, a mountain, or walls, which normally would slow down or even inhibit the movement of a radio broadcast, even gamma rays, the highest frequency light rays we know of are gamma rays. In the very beyond ultraviolet, beyond X-rays, you have the gammas. And gammas normally can penetrate almost anything except for mountains and except for, you know, a few feet of lead. But strangely, regardless of the distance, Tiller even put his water samples behind lead, behind any layer of shielding. They always did it. They always attained their goal. So what that tells us is if we are, you go back to Einstein and the clouds clearing all three times, when the intention is pure, and you're really in love with what you're doing, you're broadcasting from your heart center, and then your thought has to be consistent for at least 30 days to get results. Now, how many of us, you know, saw The Secret and we thought, oh, I tried that. I wanted, you know, to manifest $100,000 and it never came. And, you know, just, this guy just right. got lucky.
And you're talking about The Secret as featured on Oprah Winfrey.
Right.
You're talking about that, The Secret, that she did all the interviews on her website and everything. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. If you just want something because you want it, and let's say you go, oh, no, that's not going to happen. Or you change your mind. You don't really want that. You want this. And then you see another magazine and you go, no, I don't want that. See, when we're changing our minds all the time, we're not being very passionate, and we're also not being very consistent. And what the evidence seems to suggest is that consciousness is very patient, like the earth, like the change of the seasons. It is a very, probably when we get to the ultimate math on the conversion of how powerful consciousness is, before we even get that far, we realize that it's slow and steady, but amazingly powerful. It's far more powerful than we can even imagine.
Sure.
Because this is just child's play here. You know, we're trying to, for example, I mean, this is like 9 times out of 10 what everybody wants. They want love in their life. They want success. They want, you know, they want these things in their life. And I think, you know, The Secret came out at a time when, you know, the economy's bad. You know, everything is falling apart in America. People want to know, are they responsible? Is there something more they can do to get that? And what I'm seeing is passion and sincerity is the most important part of your personal broadcasting. The second most important part is that, you know, don't expect $1,000 or $100,000 or $10 million to just drop out of the sky. I mean, that may happen. It may happen. But you have to be in love with your process and what you're doing, whether you're an architect, an astronomer, a musician, an artist,
right.
a biologist. This dialogue you're creating with the intelligent part of the universe is going to give you insights. And if you follow those insights, you're going to accelerate in whatever it is you do and be better at it and therefore be successful.
And I love that idea, and I think that that's really cool. But then to go back to that, the effect of the physicist on the experiments and the fact that it's consciousness, not just physical energy, wouldn't it be fair to argue that maybe that's too hard a conclusion to draw if science already has if there is already a disparity amongst the scientists on how far our energy fields can be measured, that you know, you had, I don't remember if it was Dr. Tiller or not, saying that they measure, you can measure one's electrical output from 2 to 3 feet away, but other scientists say, no, we can get that from 10 or 12 feet away, and maybe our energy fields are actually stronger and travel a further distance than we have the instruments by which to measure them.
Yeah, that's great. Now, here's the answer to that. First, Okay. Yes, I mean, lead and rock and mountains and, concrete, enough of it can block electromagnetism. For example, if you're in the basement of a parking structure, you can't hear your buddy on your cell phone. And of course, your cell phone is microwaves, which are that's where we broadcast television, which is a little higher in frequency than the radio spectrum. And so you think, okay, if it's just the biophotons that are emitting off of the human being that's affecting the quantum experiments, then you just have to put those barriers between them. But once again, this is where the experiments get very rigorous. And this is, in Claude Swanson's book, The Synchronized Universe, they take a psychic and they put a Faraday cage around a hidden Chinese character. And this was done in China, and then it was followed up in the United States.
Just explain a Faraday cage for people that don't know.
Okay, a Faraday cage, you're trying to block all electromagnetism, which is radio, television, satellite pollution, and you just use thick walls of lead, and then they have this electromagnetic cage around that. That means that whatever's going to go on inside the cage is not being influenced by all this other information. Because we've got hundreds of satellites floating around our planet, so it could be anything, right? So once you block out all that stuff, then they put a photomultiplier tube inside with outputs coming into meters. And photomultiplier tubes basically multiply and reflect photons, small amounts of light. They're very, very low light sensitive. And a psychic will travel out of body, go into the cage in consciousness, just simple intention, guess the Chinese character correctly more times than not, and the photomultiplier tube goes off. Now, how the heck could that be?
Right. If it were just energy.
It was just electromagnetism, which now this leads Dr. Tiller to believe, and Claude Swanson and many others, that consciousness is more subtle than even the highest frequency, smallest wavelengths we've ever measured, which is beyond the Planck scale. And that means, what that means to a physicist is utterly outrageous. Oh, my God. The fact that it can go through anything with 100% accuracy, no resistance, that does mean that we've eliminated the hypothesis that when Heisenberg and Niels Bohr came to Einstein and said our minds are affecting the results of the experiments, it is not the light emissions. It's more subtle than that. But when you use the word subtle in comparison to frequencies, it actually means more powerful, not weaker, as the word suggests.
And in this case, then, it seems like that there's a level of consciousness into which we can tap, so that if the power is out there, it would suggest that somehow we can almost sort of uplink to that, almost like a satellite, where we then become part of a greater consciousness, which is a pre-existing force in the universe, that when we die, consciousness will continue to live on. It's just we won't have our piece of it on this, in the living plane.
Well, exactly. But you see, the fact that consciousness, you go back to Max Planck and Einstein and you say, okay, if these guys knew and Heisenberg knew and Bohr knew, and there's this great book, Gino Serge, another Nobel Prize winner, writes this book called Faust in Copenhagen, which I couldn't put down. And it's all about how all of these men and women, Lise Meitner included and Madame Curie and all of them, they all needed each other to eventually win the Nobel Prize. It was like a group synergy. But they all knew this. They all knew this before we developed the atomic bomb. And we came to World War I. We took all of those great minds, and instead of focusing on this subject of consciousness, which I believe needs to be added as a true force among the four forces, it would become the fifth or sixth force, depending on where you count from. But they all now have to work on weapons. We take our greatest minds, and in the middle of this, they all have to divert their attention to weapons. And, of course, Einstein does this in World War II when, in fact, it was Lise Meitner who was considered the true mother of the atomic bomb. It was all really her idea to fission uranium. And then it's a young physicist named Albert O. C. Nier who discovers the uranium explosive uranium isotope, and then Glenn Seaborg and Macmillan win the prize and Nobel Prize in Physics for discovering another level of the explosive uranium isotope. The Manhattan Project goes, and then you have the atomic bomb. So that's where everybody went. We went to this very physical, mechanistic, explosive universe, and we forgot where this whole thing started. It started with this great passion to understand what this mind is that Max Planck is talking about.
Well, okay, but that also coincides with, perhaps, let's use our government. Does that not coincide at a time when physicists start to become very aware of the power of this consciousness and research is being done? And that's something which it poses too strong a threat for the government to encourage people to know about.
This is the most incredible thing, what you're talking about here. Hans Eisenseck, who is considered the most quoted living psychologist, you know, at the time of his death in 1997, actually insinuated in writing that there was a conspiracy that involved 30 major universities, institutions around the world in England. This is one of the greatest psychologists of our time in the 20th century, is actually stating that there's a conspiracy to hide the data about the true power of consciousness in the mind. And so what happens is, you know, when I talk to people like Dr. Cloud Swanson from MIT, William Tiller, and all of them, multiple PhDs, MDs, they all say that the data was a smear campaign, an intentional smear campaign was created to make it look like, yes, you know, we explored mind over matter, all of these things, and we found that it wasn't really true, that there wasn't enough evidence to suggest that anything was going on there. And the smear campaign was there. Because, for example, if you believe, you see, once you've seen enough data and enough positive evidence, and remember, you know, I really appreciate a person like Dr. Tiller who, I mean, looking at him, he looks like a wizard. He looks like a true master because he's seen 30 years of evidence, and then he publishes his data. He doesn't do one experiment and go, oh, my God, you know, I found the answer. He does it over and over and over like a mantra until he knows for sure it's there. So when he comes forward and he presents this data, and Cloud Swanson can tell you the same thing, you go through this excruciating peer review board system. And the peer review system says, we will not allow this data to be acknowledged and to win the Nobel Prize, because if everyone knows how powerful their mind is, and we haven't quite revealed how powerful the mind really is, and we will here tonight, but if they know that, oh, my God, what's going to happen if they all start thinking together in large groups? You know, what will happen? Like, for example, the 60s revolution. Right. We won't be able to control them, so we have to lie to them and tell them that this intelligent mind that Max Planck talked about in Einstein, this doesn't exist. We're just going to have our universe is going to go back to just being a machine, like a washing machine, and it just has physical forces, strong, weak, you know, gravity. And we're not going to include this mind.
It's almost like the potential exists for mental weapons of mass mind destruction. That they almost fear that somehow we could all get together and just using the power of the mind control military outcomes or be able to control the government itself just using the minds of the masses. Hang on to that response. I'll get to that coming up. And David Sirita is right. We'll reveal coming up next just how powerful your mind is. What is it that you are capable of doing? You may have glimpses of this. You may be sitting around thinking, oh, I believe that the power of the mind is infinite. And that, you know, that's an easy thing to grasp. But when you actually see what is possible, infinite will seem too small. That's all I'll tell you. Quantum Communications, that's the new DVD out from David Sirita, and you can link up to that. Grab a copy of it and some of his other work. We'll have to ask about the Mona Lisa work, too, at the very end of the show before we get into the phone calls for David Sirita coming up about an hour from now on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.